Gudrun Eslin was the daughter of a pastor in the German Evangelical Church and deeply committed to the struggle for social justice, disarmament, world peace. She attended Protestant youth gatherings. She joined in Lutheran hymns and songs for peace with equal fervor. She worked hard at school. She studied in the Bible class at her father's church. She was going to be a teacher. She wanted to make the world a better place to live in. When she left home and went to university, she became more politically active. She campaigned hard for the Social Democratic Party in the election campaign of 1965, but when in the following year the party formed a grand coalition with the right-wing Christian Democrats, Eslin felt betrayed. So she abandoned the mainstream SPD for the more extreme Socialist Student League. And with them, she demonstrated against the Vietnam War, pelted America House with eggs, distributed inflammatory leaflets, and wrecked the offices of university professors. But soon that wasn't enough for her. Just as she concluded that her father's Christianity wouldn't change the world, and then that politics couldn't, so now she decided that demonstrations wouldn't achieve anything either. The Nobel Prize-winning novelist Günter Grass, who knew her in those days, said she was idealistic with an inborn loathing of any compromise. She had a yearning for the absolute. And so she teamed up with Andreas Baader and turned to direct action. She was part of the Baader-Meinhof gang, which was to Germany in the 1970s, I guess something of what Al-Qaeda is to the West today. Together they set fire to shops, robbed banks, planted murderous bombs. Eventually she was arrested and sentenced to life imprisonment. And in Stammheim prison, like Baader and Meinhof, she committed suicide. It's a classic story, isn't it, of idealism turning to disillusionment and then despair. The young would-be teacher studying in the Bible class who lands up a terrorist and commits suicide. There are many reasons why people doubt, but here's a very powerful one: disillusionment. It is to the disillusioned as much as to anyone else that Luke speaks this evening. That is the doubt of the two who went on the kind of Sunday afternoon activity that any self-respecting child grumbles about, a 7-mile walk. Well, that's what's happening when we pick up the story in Luke 24 and we pick it up at verse 13. Two of them were going to a village called Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem, and they were talking with each other about everything that had happened. And as they talked and discussed these things with each other, Jesus himself came up and walked along with them. But they were kept from recognizing him. And as you read the beginning of this incident, one thing is clear, isn't it? You catch up very quickly on what I've called the doubt of disillusionment. The doubt of disillusionment. There are classic signs. Look at verse 17. You see, they're downcast. Their faces are downcast. Sadness written right across them. Long-faced, as if they'd lost their best friend. By verse 24, you notice they're bewildered. You can see as they're talking, this stranger doesn't seem to know what's gone on, and so they start to tell him what's happened in Jerusalem in these last days. And they've got all the pieces. Did you notice that as Richard read it to us? It's as if they've got all the pieces of the jigsaw. They knew the Jesus story well. You don't need to rehearse the facts with them. Yes, he was someone powerful in word and deed. Yes, they'd crucified him. They'd even heard rumors of the resurrection. You pick that up in verse 24? You see across the page, the women have been to the tomb early. And then some of our companions went to the tomb and found it just as the women had said. They've got all the facts. They don't need to go over them again. They just can't seem to fit them together. By the way, I do hope Cleopas had a sense of humor, don't you? I mean, when he bought his copy of Luke's bestseller, and I imagine he did what all of us do and raced through it to find the bit where he features, and found he will go down in posterity as the man who looked Jesus in the eyes and said with utter disillusionment, "Him they did not see." Now, I don't accuse New Testament Christians of not being able to laugh at themselves. Yeah, there's downcast, there's bewilderment, there's blindness. It's another classic feature of this disillusionment. They can't make the facts add up. So what had happened to their religion? Well, Cleopas explains it back in verse 21. He said, "We had hoped he was the one who was going to redeem Israel. That's what Messiah was meant to do, and he can't pull it off now." You almost wonder whether Cleopas had been there the week earlier on Palm Sunday, you know, with the nationalist songs and no doubt the nationalist flags along with the palms. Certainly, his scriptures, our Old Testament, had hopes of a liberator who would free his people from occupying powers and end the exile. We had hoped. Those three words sum up the ashes of many a person's faith. Now, not recruiting Jesus to a nationalist cause very often these days. Not even that his death brings disillusionment anymore, because we know the story before we begin. But it's often others' deaths, isn't it? You've not heard people say on those circumstances, "We had hoped"? Why, we'd even prayed when our friend was ill. "One thing I asked of God..." But no, he couldn't even do that. It's not his plans being scuppered so much now as ours. We had hoped, you know, if God had healed my child, if God had mended my marriage, if God had just opened that opportunity, we had hoped that there was a God, living, relevant, a force for good in the world of the 21st century. We thought of him like that once. Talked of him like that, sang about him like that. We had hoped, but not any longer. Do you know people who talk that way? Do you know yourself, perhaps, anything of that sadness, that bewilderment? Maybe you know how for some, the sadness has even become a sneer, patronizing smile. Oh, yes, we hope that too. You know, we were naive once ourselves. But we've grown out of it now. For others, all that remains is the heavy heart of a broken idealism. We had hoped he was the one. The doubt of disillusionment. And it's fueled by what I've called the spin of selectivity. The spin of selectivity. Watch as Cleopas tells of all their sadness and their heavy hearts. Watch Jesus' response. Will you look on to verse 25? "We had hoped," said Cleopas, "and he said to them, 'How foolish you are and slow of heart to believe. How thick.'" It's a bit of a shock, really, isn't it? Just when you expect Jesus to be at his sensitive, tender best, he is shockingly robust. And as he so consistently is with those of us whose problem is that we're slow, Jesus is also remarkably patient at the same time. He said to them, "How foolish you are and how slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have spoken. Did not the Christ have to suffer these things and then enter his glory? And beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he explained to them what was said in all the scriptures concerning himself." Yeah, we had hoped, they said. And their hopes had not been without basis in the Bible. It does speak of one who will bring liberation, who will end exile, who will see justice done, who will crush enemies. It's just that that's not all it says. And they'd fallen for the spin of their own selectivity. And you see, as Jesus fronts them up to it, you noticed those alls, did you? All that the prophets have spoken. Beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he explained to them what was said in all the scriptures concerning himself. Now, I doubt that Jesus was peppering them with proof texts, but for the couple of hours it would have taken them to walk to Emmaus, he took them on a tour of the Old Testament from Genesis through to Malachi. Unfortunately, no tapes are available. And you can't download it. You'll just have to do the work yourself another time. But he obviously explained what was promised throughout those scriptures about the Christ, the Messiah. A figure of great power and justice, certainly. A figure to rescue his people and end their exile, definitely. But as he would have pointed out from the Passover in Exodus to the suffering servant in Isaiah, a figure too who would rescue through sacrifice, who would taste God's judgment so that his people could escape it, whose road to triumph was deliberately rooted through the death he would face for his rebellious people. Did not the Christ have to suffer these things and then enter his glory? See, the problem with selectivity is that it puts a spin on our expectations and creates false ones, doesn't it? We just pick out a few things and hang on to them. I mean, we're all prone to selectivity, aren't we? It's part and parcel of our lives. You remember selective deafness as a child? You know, you ain't got to whisper about food and you're there. Come to homework, you've got to shout if you want a pen picked up. Funnily enough, you'll find selective deafness recurs later on again as well. Parents are selectively deaf. Grandparents can be extremely selectively deaf. When it's selective faith, that's trusting in a God of part of the Bible. The problem is it leads to false expectations and then too often to disillusionment. And we can all be prone to it. We don't realize we've just got a narrow base of what the Bible says. And there comes a time when we see it doesn't fit the real world we live in. Oh. And we get disillusioned and give up on it. The only cure is patient exposure to all the scriptures. Constantly to measure our idea of God against everything I find in the Bible. Cleopas is exposed to all the scriptures and it changes his expectations. We had hoped he was going to be the one to redeem Israel. He'd assumed Jesus' death meant he couldn't be the one. Now he's heard that death was part of the deal. It was written into Messiah's job description. It was integral to his rescue package. It meant God's Messiah was working off a different agenda to Cleopas's. Could it be a deeper, profounder, better one? You know, when faced with disillusionment, actually, in order to prevent disillusionment, I must keep exposing myself to the scriptures. Will we keep checking our expectations about God against God's? Will I keep viewing God in the light of my vision or his? Have we let Easter truth, the Christ had to suffer these things and then enter his glory, speak into our disillusionment? Because as it does here, as the spin of his own selectivity is pushed away from in front of his eyes. So you see at the end of this incident what I've called the triumph of the truth. The triumph of the truth. At one level, Luke's writing is in a very factual tone. And yet it's hard to disguise the growing sense of excitement as this story goes on. Jesus is persuaded to stay. And as he breaks bread, why, look what we're told. Verse 31. Well, when he was at the table with them, he took bread, gave thanks, broke it, and began to give it to them. And then their eyes were opened, and they recognized him. We're not quite told how. Was it a familiar gesture? They'd seen him break bread like that before. Did they see the nail marks in his wrists as maybe his sleeves fell back? Who knows? But they recovered their perspective. They saw the facts for what they were and Jesus for who he is, the risen Messiah. And it makes sense of their experience. You see how they go on? They asked each other, verse 32, were not our hearts burning within us when he talked with us on the road and opened the scriptures to us? Weren't our hearts burning within us because of the relief at things making sense? Because of the excitement at a vision that both overwhelmed their expectations and was deeply satisfying? I can still remember the excitement when, as a Christian, just out of the egg, so to speak, the Bible for the first time began to make sense to me. And the words, I could understand them. I'm still excited. I hope you haven't lost it. When you see a truth you've never seen before, oh, that's what it's about. Well, they're like this. They can't keep the truth to themselves. So in spite of what they said to Jesus earlier, back in verse 29, about how it's nearly evening and the day's almost over, what do they do at the end of it all? Well, verse 33, they got up and they returned at once to Jerusalem. Hey, and if you took in what happened at the end, you've got to feel a bit sorry for Cleopas and his friend, haven't you? I mean, they've got so excited, you know, having walked all the way from Jerusalem to Emmaus, they immediately bolt out of the house, jog all the way back, the 7-mile jog, and when they get there to break the good news, they discover, oh, the other lot know it already. It's tough being a disciple. It's true, the others say to him, the Lord has risen. And what about redeeming Israel? Well, horizons are broader now. Israel's not reduced to a mere nationalistic definition. It's not the modern secular state in the Middle East today. It's the people of God gathered from all over the world for the presence of God. A rescue as deep and wide as God's new creation plans. And Messiah's resurrection is the start of this new creation. It can only begin when God's people have been made fit to live in that new creation, when the real exile is ended, the exile of sinful people from a holy God. It's why on Easter Day we remember Jesus' death as we did this morning by breaking bread together. Today signals the triumph of that Good Friday sacrifice. Mission accomplished, debt paid, estrangement over. It is finished. And we can share that triumph with Cleopas. We can step into those new creation plans ourselves. Our experience can't race ahead to encompass all that God still has scheduled for the future, but we can have the status of new creation people now. We can enjoy the first tastes of that life. We can hold the boarding pass for the journey still to come. In the public symbolic way, it's exactly that boarding pass that Akiko picked up earlier in the service. It's true. The Lord has risen. The new creation world will come to pass. And you see, no disillusioningly untimely death. No door closed on an opportunity in the here and now can invalidate the boarding pass. Listen to Andy Maycock. He's had cerebral palsy since birth. He was brought up as a Christian, but he didn't really accept it for himself. He knew all the theory, but saw it as a harsh religion based on reward and punishment. If you were a naughty boy, you went to hell, and if you were a good boy, you didn't. Now, there's an understanding based on selectivity. So as time went on and his disability grew stronger, he said, I used to think, how can there be a God if I am like I am? How dare he make me like I am? There's the disillusionment. But later still, Andy, like Akiko, met good Christian friends and people who explained the Christian message to him. And he said of those opportunities, he said, I'm glad I got the opportunity to look at things like Jesus did. He suffered. He had adversity. But look how much he loved. Jesus, he said, has changed me from being a victim of circumstances into the son of a king. I may still be crippled on the outside, but I'm no longer crippled on the inside. And this is one bubble that is never going to burst. It's true. The Lord has risen. And that makes a world of difference. Actually, it makes for a different world. A world that Andy Maycock and Akiko will speak of. Not one in which the passionate idealism of a Gudrun Enslin for justice and peace is lost. But one in which the distortions and travesties of justice are met not with violent intolerance, but with the painful, patient application of mercy and hope. It's true. The Lord is risen. And if that truth triumphs in our disillusionment, why, there's a whole new world opening up. A whole new hope that we can confidently grasp. It's true. It is true. The Lord has risen. Let's pray. Lord, renew our faith in your Christ. Grant us your vision for your world and its future. And may the mercy and hope that Jesus died and rose again to bring be ours this Easter. Amen.